council has had a recurring interest in the topic of TDDs and has asked for a presentation. When we stop to think about it, there happens to be probably the expert in Missouri in the community, and it isn't on our staff. So Craig Van Maitre has graciously agreed to do a presentation for us about TDDs, as well as two other instruments, CIDs and NIDs. So without taking up any time, Craig?
Thank you, members of the council. My name's Craig Van Maitre. My office is at 1103 East Broadway. I don't know that I am a world expert or even state expert on TDDs or CIDs, but we do represent a number of them around the state. Some of the ones that I've been intimately involved with here in town are the Conley Road, Broadway Fairview, Shopsis Stadium, Rockbridge, Bryanstone Parkway. So we've used them, and then in Springfield, Missouri, I've got a community improvement district called James River Commons District that has a large shopping center there that it operates. I'm not necessarily going to have a train of thought to interrupt, so as soon as a question occurs to you, if you've got one that you feel like you want to ask, go ahead and ask, because it's important that you try to understand these as much as you're interested in it, because they're going to continue to be a presence. They are special tax districts, just like a sewer district is a special tax district. In a lot of ways, it's like any other ways that municipal governments raise money. They have statutory authority to do certain things. They have statutory authority to take people's money from them and to spend it on certain things. And so when you go through this presentation with me, these questions that are up on the board now will occur to you. I will try to answer as many of them as I can in the limited time that I've got. I'm happy to meet with you one-on-one if you have additional questions. I'm happy to provide supplemental report to you if you feel like you need more detail than I'll be providing tonight. I think the main impetus behind these special tax districts comes from the Hancock Amendment to the Missouri Constitution, which limits the ability of governments to raise taxes. And because of that, the legislative response was to say, well, what can we control on this in order to allow people to raise taxes to provide for certain public improvements? One of the ways of doing that is to create your own sort of mini electorate. If the Hancock Amendment says, as it does, that there's limits on state revenues, that there's limits on what the state can do insofar as raising taxes and on local governments as well, then what can we do to assist local governments to get around this, to circumvent this limitation? And the answer that the legislature came up with in these special tax districts was, well, we'll define the electorate in such a way that it makes it easier to do so. And as we'll see as we get through these, the limitation on voter approval before any tax, license, or fee can be levied, which is what the Hancock Amendment prescribes, is circumvented in effect by saying if we create a district that's a defined geographical area and there's no registered voters that live in that area, then property owners get to vote and those property owners can approve taxes. So that, in a nutshell, is how these special tax districts work to the advantage of the developer who takes advantage of that particular technique as a way of funding the extremely expensive improvements that are necessary to make any kind of large-scale development work. So I want to talk about three different districts, but I'm only going to spend 1 minute on neighborhood improvement districts. People sometimes use this term, neighborhood improvement district, interchangeably with TDDs and CIDs and TIF districts and so on, and they're confusing. But a neighborhood improvement district is sort of like a sewer district. It requires a two-thirds vote to form it. It requires a two-thirds vote to impose the real estate taxes that are involved. They're actually special assessments. And if the local government allows this to occur, and typically what is involved then for, as far as obtaining financing for that, neighborhood improvement district is an obligation which becomes the obligation of the municipality. The full faith and credit of the city is pledged to the neighborhood improvement district bonds, and the municipality secures its ability to get repaid for that by, in effect, having these special assessments against real estate within the district. That typically, a neighborhood improvement district, therefore, is typically not a development of the type of technique that a developer uses in a typical shopping center arrangement. So I doubt that you're interested. I haven't seen any developers really use neighborhood improvement districts as a mechanism, because it would require a great deal of cooperation with the city council. And as a practical matter, you'd be putting the full faith and credit of the city's finances behind an NID obligation or bond. And that would be something that would be very cumbersome for a developer to try to take advantage of, except in an extraordinary circumstance. So instead, what the typical developers look to, and what I think when we get to the problems that you'll see with these developments, what they want to take advantage of are tools to help them allay or lay off costs that are associated with preparing the public improvements necessary to make a large-scale development work. And the two primary tools they use in this area are TDDs and CIDs, and in the cities, they also use TIF districts. You all are just now getting started with the advantages and disadvantages of TIFs. I didn't want to talk about them tonight because I think that's also beyond the scope of this presentation. But from a what you've seen in the past and what you'll see in the future, I think, are CIDs and TDDs. So let's talk about what a CID is. It's a community improvement district. It's a special taxing district authorization that's in the that you'll find in the Missouri statutes, and it gives a community improvement district the powers that we're talking about to raise taxes by charging sales taxes or real estate taxes or special assessments, and to use that money to pay for improvements. And how do they typically use these monies to pay for improvements? Well, the improvements, when they're built, and typically sales taxes, will generate sales tax revenues. And so you have this stream of money that comes in to this district. And the district then can, in effect, pledge that revenue to the payment of bonded obligations. Now, if I am collecting, let's say, $50,000 a month from some source, I could spend $50,000 that month and wait till the next month and spend another $50,000, but that is not what the developers do or anybody else that has a stream of money. They, in effect, anticipate that stream of money by saying to a lender, loan me $5 million and I'll pay you $50,000 a month, and I will pay you this $50,000 a month from the tax revenues that I think I can predictably raise once I get my shopping center done. Now, in the past, lenders were willing to take those promises at face value. In the current lending climate, they want to see the shopping center up and built and operating and tax revenues actually being collected before they loan the money. But the point is, if you have a development that is eligible for this sales tax type revenue to come in, you can get financing various ways. Sometimes lenders, they used to be willing to take just the credit of the district alone and say, we don't care if you give us any personal guarantees, we'll take the money that you bring into this development in the form of sales taxes and take that as payment on our debt, and we won't make anybody sign any personal guarantees. Now, with the 2008 behind us and lenders a little bit more cautious, they typically want various types of personal guarantees from the developer, but it's still a great deal for the developer, because if some major improvements are required, instead of having to fund those improvements out of rent that you collect from the development, instead of having to come up with the money out of your pocket, you have these tax revenues, which are specifically authorized by the state legislature to be collected. You can use those revenues to get financing to pay for streets and sewers, curbs and gutters, sidewalks, water detention areas, things that otherwise would make your development so much more expensive and therefore dictate a much higher rent, which would make it less competitive with other potential landlords. And so it's a tool that, as I say, sophisticated and larger developers want to use. So another advantage that a community improvement district and a TDD has is that the bonds that are issued can pay tax or can pay interest that is exempt from taxation for federal and state purposes. So that means that the purchaser of that bond may be satisfied with a lesser interest rate, costing the overall development less money to build, because the revenue from those bonds does not have to be reported as taxable income for either state or federal purposes. Now, they're subject to some very complex limitations and regulations, but still, as a general principle, the idea that you can give a lender income in the form of interest that they don't have to pay tax on is attractive. Now, what can they use the money that they raise in this fashion for? Well, they can use it for, in a CID, for a lot of purposes that are associated with the development. I'll get into that in a minute. But the important thing, the important difference between a CID and a TDD that I want to get into is the manner in which it's formed. A CID is formed with the consent of and pursuant to an ordinance that would be adopted by you as a city council, and it requires a petition to be filed by property owners. They got to be more than 50% by value. They got to be more than 50% by number of property owners in a district. Well, obviously, in a typical district of this type that's formed, there's just one owner. It may be possibly two or three owners, but typically it's one owner. There's nobody that lives on that development that's a voting resident, and so it's just the property owner that votes with respect to the formation. It does that voting, in effect, by filing a petition with the city, and then the city, it's up to the city to figure out what it wants in exchange for granting its consent to the formation of that district. Now, when we get into a TDD, you'll see that it is formed differently with much less city control. But once the petition for the formation of the CID is formed, then it's governed by its board of directors. It has to have at least 5 and not more than 30 directors, but the statute requires that these directors either be owners of the real estate or of a business within the district, or legal representatives, duly authorized representatives of one of those two people, the owner of real estate or a business in that area. The petition that creates this district, the CID, can prescribe that it's either going to be a nonprofit corporation or a political subdivision. Most of these are formed as political subdivisions because, if formed as a political subdivision, then your ability to raise taxes, including sales taxes, is granted, and if it's not a political subdivision, it doesn't exist. So you have to specify in your petition how you want your board to be elected, but the typical way that a CID board is picked is you try to, as the developer's council, you try to circumscribe the political organization's power to name people willy-nilly to the board of directors. You want to make sure that the people on the board of directors are sympathetic to your cause and are sophisticated. But typically the way it's done is the mayor, presiding officer of the municipality, appoints with the advice and consent of the council. So how does a CID raise money? Well, it raises it through taxes. And if it is a political subdivision, it can levy sales taxes, and it can also levy special assessments and real estate taxes. The power, what it does with its money then, is it can use it to buy real estate. It can use it to build streets, sewers, just about anything that's got a public use component to it that you can think of, it can use its money for. Now, to appreciate community improvement district, you kind of have to contrast it with a transportation development district. TDD law has been around since 1990, so about 8 more years than the CID law. It was created in order to create a special tax district that would just build transportation infrastructure and related improvements. You saw that the CID purposes are much broader. But a TDD is formed primarily to develop transportation-related infrastructure. So that is a lot of the same things, sidewalks, streets, related curbs, gutters, sewers, surface water drainage stuff that relates to the transportation infrastructure. It is formed through the filing of a petition with the circuit court of the county in which you want the TDD to operate. The circuit court then has the power to enter a decree which forms the TDD, but before you have the court entering its decree, you have to notify MoDOT, the Missouri Highways and Transportation Commission, and you have to notify the municipality or governmental entity in which the district is going to be located. And you have to figure out who's going to be the controlling transportation authority. So if you're not going to be building state highways as part of your TDD, then typically it's just the local governmental entity that's the controlling transportation authority. Sometimes you have a district where you're building state improvements as well as municipal improvements. That's the Conley Road situation where if you're building, in effect, access roads that connect Highway 63 to Conley Road, but it's also building improvements that are purely municipal in nature. So in those cases, you have, in effect, two transportation authorities. So when you file your petition for the creation of a TDD, you are, in effect, suing the city and suing the state and saying, I want to form this district. Speak now or forever hold your peace. In the past, nobody objected to this formation, typically, because the developer had gone and said, here's what I'd like to do. Do you have any problems with the idea? But once the district is formed by a decree of the circuit court, then the city really has nothing to do with it except insofar as its component of the improvements are concerned, and then only with respect to the approval of the plans and specifications. So the circuit court has a hearing, it enters its decree, and the district is formed. Now, MoDOT has the right to appoint non-voting advisors to the board of directors of TDDs, but it never does this. I don't know if they've ever sent anybody to any of the meetings that we've ever had, our TDD board of directors meetings. TDD raises money the same way the CID does. It can impose sales taxes, and it can impose special assessments and real estate taxes if it gets the necessary approval. Obviously, in the situation where it's nothing but real estate owned by the developer is the only voter, and the developer votes to approve these taxes within that district. So once those taxes are approved, and then you use those taxes to obtain bonds or to obtain your financing, neither the TDD nor the CID, for that matter, can be liquidated or done away with until the district's obligations are fully paid or appropriately assured. So these districts then can last for a good many years, particularly if you set up the amortization schedule for the district's obligations over a number of years, 20 or 40, up to 40 years. And then they can be refinanced, and so they can continue on after that. These districts have limited condemnation authority, particularly a TDD has got the ability to condemn property if MoDOT or the city in this circumstance approves of the condemnation. Now, Judge Oxenhandler has been the judge I've most frequently been in front of in forming TDDs, insists upon certain language in the decree itself that limits the authority to condemn property unless and until you've made an offer of compensation equal to the average of two appraisals and you've done your best, and then on top of that you've got to get the permission from either MoDOT or the city to effect a condemnation. As a result, to my knowledge, at least around central Missouri area, there has not been any condemnation on the part of the TDD or CID. But that's not to say it wouldn't happen, or that in the case, in an appropriate case, the city wouldn't defer to a particular district the condemnation cost, expense, and complexity instead of handling it itself with its own staff.
If I may interrupt here with a question, could you flip back to that slide? As a general rule, for example, the state, the various TDDs on Stadium, these are projects that the city or the and MoDOT would have wanted, and I don't know if there haven't been condemnations because the land was already owned and acquired. For example, the Stadium project, that's presumably all MoDOT right away already.
Let me see if I can state what I think I understand to be the case. In the first place, there are four TDDs out along Stadium that mm-hmm. are contributing, in effect, towards, is it four or three? There's the shops at Stadium.
There were three.
No, I think it's three. Shops at Stadium. There's the mall, the Columbia Mall mm-hmm. TDD, and then there's the Raw Walters. And I'm not sure I can remember the name of his.
I think there, yeah, it, I don't remember the name, and you might be right about a fourth one.
Crossroads.
Crossroads.
Well, Mike, that's the Raw Walters one. There's different locations. The TDDs don't have to be contiguous as far as their areas.
So that's interesting.
So a TDD can, as long as all parcels are within 5 miles of each other, you can have different parcels. So you might have one TDD that's got a parcel and jump over land that's owned by another TDD and grab another mm-hmm. parcel and so on. So
that would be an example where you're building a shopping center away from a highway, but you might be doing an improvement at a highway, for example, an interchange.
Exactly, or you might want to have, you might have two parcels and two developments within a couple of miles of each other, but you want to use the money for something that arguably benefits them, either a widening of a highway that connects the two of them or something like that.
I get it, yeah.
In this circumstance, what we have here is three TDDs agreeing that their monies can be used by MoDOT and the city to build the stadium corridor improvements. But some of the improvements are planned for land that is not owned by either the city or the state. Mm-hmm. And there are condemnations threatened in order to get the necessary right-of-way, where the city is saying, we will pay 10 cents a square foot or whatever they're offering, and the property owner is saying, I want $1 a square foot. And they're negotiating, but if they don't come to terms, then the city, on behalf of this effort, or MoDOT, on behalf of this effort, will condemn. Mm-hmm. But their source of funding then will be, at least in part, the revenues from this joint or this multiple CDD, this combination mm-hmm. of TDDs in that vicinity.
Because as a general rule, they've been in cooperation with the transportation authorities in question, at least so far.
Well, they're all cooperating.
And then I didn't understand if the circuit court could the second point here, they could, at a subsequent date after the formation, enter an additional restriction?
No, at the time of formation, in the decree which says there shall be a new TDD.
Mm-hmm. So everything on this slide happens at the time of formation. Got it.
Now, what are the problems with these entities? And I think what I've listed here, First, six bullet points are the ones that you typically hear, and they definitely exist. First, taxation without representation. Well, there is no, quote, taxation without representation from a legal perspective because the persons specify. Hey, I appreciate that. Vote of people who are, by statute, designated as the authorized voters. in this instance. But the definition of the authorized voter is property owners if there's no registered voters within the proposed district. So you get a vote that literally complies with the Hancock Amendment, but then when the development occurs and you have thousands of shoppers shopping there, there are the people actually paying the sales tax. So the comment that you typically hear is, well, it's taxation without representation because the people who are going to pay the tax didn't get to vote. But the rebuttal to that is, if you go shop in some other town and pay the sales tax in some other town, you're not voting on those sales taxes either. And yet you choose to shop there, and you don't have to shop there, and therefore you are electing, in effect, whether or not to pay that tax by electing whether or not to shop in that particular district. Lack of control or input by the city. No question about it. The way a TDD is set up, the city, once it's set up, has very little control over it, except in the form of the negotiations that go on in the context of any large-scale development. Lack of control over expenditures. There's no question that the city or any other political subdivision doesn't have control over it. Instead, it's controlled by the directors who have a fiduciary duty to the development or to the district, and they have a fiduciary duty to not disregard any laws. But these laws were written by lawyers for developers. And so laws do not prescribe for very much oversight other than an audit every 2 or 3 years. And the records are public and can be inspected, but it's a very complex set of transactions that go on, and the laws are complex. And so notwithstanding the fact that they're public, you wind up with very little oversight by any governmental entity other than the district itself, which is a political subdivision, which is a governmental entity charged with its own administration and supervision. City lacks the staff to audit and spend any time looking at the detailed finances of these TDDs. Most TDDs don't really comply with the Sunshine Laws. The Sunshine Laws have very little teeth in them, so disregarding Sunshine Laws usually is not, doesn't cause any consequences to anyone. And so there is a good deal of stuff that goes on inside these districts around the state that you would not approve of as publicly elected persons. I have no doubt about it. Now, you know, occasionally some of them come to light. There was a TDD formed in the south part of town several years ago, was liquidated, in effect terminated earlier this year, as I recall it. When they had meetings of the board of directors, they didn't have it down here at the city hall. They didn't publish notice, post notice of it on any public bulletin board. Did things. There's no punishment for not letting people know what's going on. So there's a lot of stuff that probably could be done. If you were a legislator, you would think, well, it should be done, but the state's got lots of other problems that the legislature believes is more pressing than regulating or imposing additional regulations on TDDs and CIDs, and so as a result, they pretty well move under the radar.
May I ask you a question to that?
Yeah.
What happened to the money when they dissolved that TDD?
When it's what?
What happened to the money that had been raised through that TDD?
I guess in this case he means if there's a surplus.
The advantage to that particular TDD, which we took the responsibility of terminating, was we didn't form it. As far as I know, it didn't make any money because it didn't have any sales tax revenues there. I don't think it had any real estate tax revenues, and so it was really, for lack of a better description, just a bunch of papers sitting in somebody's desk drawer someplace. But there are lots of TDDs around the state where you really don't know exactly what happened to the revenues because either don't get audits done or the audits that are done are pretty cursory and there's not detailed financial records and so on. Now, I've always known that Columbia is a goldfish bowl, and so the DDDs that we represent, when they have meetings, they have them here. Early days, they were attended pretty religiously by the news media. We published notice, we published an agenda. Over the years, we've had several of the newspapers at least come and make an effort to go through some of this stuff. One of the Missourian spent several weeks in our office going through our records on these various TDDs and piecing together a story, which I thought was a pretty objective, well-balanced, well-written, intelligent story about TDDs here in Columbia. And it had little interactive diagrams that you could go on the website and look at. And I think there was zero, if maybe one, comment that appeared in the paper as a result of it. I mean, so obviously the public, it's not a burning issue with the public as opposed to other things. So it's one of those things where the complexity is high enough and maybe the feeling of helplessness is high enough to where people just aren't interested in it.
Mr. Van Meetry,
can I just ask a quick question? Because I am astounded. I've looked at the TDD legislation.
Right. And could I just mention that we have another item on the agenda, so we'll probably
really
want to wrap it.
All right. I'll be very
quick. We need to have enough time for questions, too.
Just the lack of accountability, within the actual legislation itself. And I just wanted to ask, is there a annual reporting requirement or are there audits done by the state periodically, or what exactly? And my concern, of course, is the money, where the money's spent, but also is it really being used on transportation-related infrastructure? I mean, those kind of audits. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of...
A state auditor is supposed to audit each one of these districts every 3 years. It's a huge, since there's so many of them, and since their staff is so small, it's a huge undertaking. We've had, I require the TDDs I represent to get an annual audit. So every year there's an audit, and it's a public document. If anybody wants it, they can see it. I have been apprehensive about this because I assumed over the years that I've been doing this that somebody would say, okay, by God, from now on you got to disclose this, and you got to do that, and you got to, and so we'd be ready for them. But
okay,
I've been wrong. Nobody's ever asked her.
And the other really quick question I have, is there any kind of restriction in terms of the administrative fees that these districts can charge?
Well, that's the other thing, is that I haven't wanted to see my clients charging anything by way of a significant administrative fee, because when you're working on a development, I suppose you could argue that you're working on the TDD also. I know in St. Louis, they charge the Wheaties out of these things.
They charge what?
They charge a huge amount.
That's what I thought.
Things.
Okay.
So we don't do that locally, but...
unrestricted.
If we wanted to, we could. And
okay.
Nobody could stop us.
All right.
Yeah.
On the stadium TDD, the money to do that improvement was borrowed from the state by the city. Is that correct? And then the TDD pays the
TDDs,
payments?
The TDDs...
Is that because the banks wouldn't loan the money to the TDD?
No, it's because the state had a fund. They had the money available, and it was a real low interest rate.
Okay.
And it didn't require, I'm not sure if, pretty sure that the entire amount wasn't necessarily borrowed by the city with respect to that project. There's a good bit of it that's a MoDOT obligation to pay, and then there's a good bit of it that is designated to be paid by these TDDs. So.
Right.
So is there anything else that staff wanted to raise with this?
Well, it's a great segue to introduce John and Richard, and we can maybe talk about roll carts a bit.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you
Mr. Van Meetry.
Like I say, if you think of other questions, we'll be happy to answer. I mean, they are public bodies, and they accountable to somebody who wants to ask a question about this.
And there's a lot to this. All right. Thanks. And now we'll proceed to roll carts and potential pilot project.
Yes, thank you. We are pleased today to be able to discuss this at some length, at least for the next 25 minutes. And staff has done a tremendous job getting ready for this. As you know, we've talked about this in concept form for some time. And at each stage of that, have decided to look a little farther into the concept. And so that has come up in this budget cycle. It's been fairly well publicized and debated. And today I'm pleased to be able to put a little more information on the table than we've had in the past. And there has been a tremendous amount of staff research done. Thank you for doing it. We have a presentation to show you today to put a lot of that information on the table. So this will be really a data dump, so to speak, and a description of what we see in the around the country as it relates to roll carts. So with that.
And I would expect you want council feedback on whether we're interested in proceeding or not.
Yes.
So hopefully we'll, how long do you think it will take to the present?
Pardon?
Well, we'll have questions during it, so hopefully we'll
yeah, and as you have,
get to
have
that
them,
point.
I'd be happy to, yeah.
Thank you, sir. As Mr. Mathis said, you know, a lot of it has to do, we call it automated trash collection, but everybody wants to attach the roll cart to it, which it does. And so what we're asking council today is we would like to implement a pilot project. That pilot project would run from January of 2013 to June 2013. We'd like to collect customer data and staff data. Want to know from our own collection people on what their ideas were and how it worked. And then we would produce a final report to council and our recommendations to that. I have with me today Richard Wieman, who's the Solid Waste Utility Manager, and I'm going to let him go into more details.
Good evening. Thanks for the opportunity to talk trash. Roll carts and automated collection, as Mr. Glasscock said, is what we were looking at to develop a pilot program for this if the council decides to go forward with it. We are looking at a program that would implement a pilot that would be as realistic as possible as we could develop to mimic what would be the true roll cart automated collection system. Let me give you an example there. If you have a roll cart, it would be difficult to stuff a sofa in it. So how do you dispose of your sofa at that point in time? We have proposed in a pilot program that there will be basically a sticker program and an extra fee for that. And you would call up a specific number, get a sticker, pay the extra fee, and once you stick it on the sofa, then we would schedule a truck by there. And we want the pilot program to be as realistic, not only with how do you handle all the waste that's involved, but what are the fees involved accordingly. And later on in the presentation, we'll talk about the fee structure and to show that there are some advantages of going to a pilot program as the same advantages would be to go to a roll cart program. During the pilot, we would be gathering not only the experience of the customer, we would get staff experience while the pilot is going on. We would compile all this data and, as Mr. Glasscock said, file a report with council. Utilize that information to design the program as we go forward. How do we hope to accomplish these goals?
Can I just ask a question? You just said, and you know, you'll utilize the data to design a program to go forward. My sort of perception was that we would do a pilot to even see if we were going to go forward. And that's one of the concerns I have with the presentation, and I'll let you go forward, but it sort of assumes that the pilot is sort of an interim thing, and there's education and pushing it forward without the feedback from the pilot.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. We are exactly where you've described, so if there's confusion there, we can clear it up. If you read the last four words of this slide, if directed by council. So we're very much lined up with what you've just expressed. The pilot is to find out whether or not we move forward. If we do, this will also inform how we move forward. So
okay.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Correct. Thank you. I was hurrying through this for a short time. But yes, directed by council. To accomplish this, we need participants. We anticipate about 600 participants would work with our routes that we could develop and get a good representative experience in roll carts. looking for 100 from each ward. We're looking at various age groups and various locations, such as East Campus area. Currently, there is actually 107 people that have volunteered for the program. This was 104 when the slide was developed. As you can see, we have a very good distribution so far. And this is even without advertising, so there's a lot of interest in this.
Can I just ask, the volunteers that you have thus far, as shown by dots on this map, are they people that contacted you through the survey, or how did they get in touch with you?
They have contacted us generally either by email or phone, and just a response from what they've been reading in the paper.
You want some feedback on that now, or would you like feedback later? We'll let you go through it, and then
okay.
We'll take the concerns okay,
thank
and
you.
Question.
We would have a large educational component of this, not only to the participants, but to the general public, in which I will talk about later. We plan on a user's pledge. In other words, they would identify how a roll cart would work, where to place it, et cetera. They would agree to the fee structure that would be involved. We would do a pre-survey so we can determine if any habits have changed or if their opinion has been changed. We anticipate the carts arriving in late December to be available for the roll cart program. If it starts in the pilot program, if it starts in January, the first week in January, and it would run 6 months with an estimated completion time at the end of June and a report to council sometimes in July.
If I can interrupt here for a moment, on the document that we have that we on our iPads, it says July 2013 collections we made by existing cruise equipment will not feature automated, which will deviate from proposed program. If you're not using the automated equipment, how will you understand the parking problems with cars parked on the street?
That's a very good question.
If you're going to do it by hand, you're not getting the real test.
Very good question. And we've anticipated that question, and we will actually either be demonstrating automated trucks during that period, or we will be renting an automated truck during that period to provide us with that experience. Okay. And you're absolutely right on target. Cul-de-sacs are a problem for automated trucks, and this is something that we would need to address and take a look at. Post surveys and compare them with the pre-surveys to see if, as I indicated, to see if there's any change in their opinions of the roll cart. We had originally started out with 32, 64, 96-gallon roll cart, and what we are seeing is that the industry is getting away from the 32-gallon roll cart. They are small, and using an automated truck, they slip and slide into the truck itself. We lose roll carts. They tend to be overpacked, and so cities and private haulers are getting away from that size, and they're replacing it with a 48-gallon roll cart. If you look out in the lobby, you can see the difference in the size. There's not much in that. Of course, that's a recommendation the council can decide on what sizes are available to the public.
Do they have other larger gallons that slip and slide or fall into the truck and have to be retrieved? Does that occasionally happen?
It doesn't happen as often on the 48 as it does the 32. It's pretty prominent on the 32-gallon with this type of collection. I mentioned earlier the pilot program to be as realistic as possible. We have put together a chart here that shows the possible fee structure. Our current fee structure right now is $1,542 per month for approximately 33,600 homes. And we looked at the industry to see what the distribution and the size of carts are, what is happening in other cities. This is our best estimate as to what we see, who would take the largest cart, who would take the smallest cart. We projected a cost fee structure that would essentially get us almost to the amount of revenue that we have now, just a little less. What is not shown there is any cost for bulky item pickup or extra bag outside of that, which would be additional, and we do not know what that is at this time.
That fee structure was identified to mirror the existing fee structure. It's not based on that they're roughly equivalent costs. Is that correct?
Would you repeat the question?
The fee structure for the automated, for the roll cart plan, it was based to try to come close, to mirror the current total, right?
The annual revenue, yes.
So it's got nothing to about how much it's going to cost to deliver the service. It's all just based to mirror what we're collecting in revenue right now.
The move to roll carts, if the council decides to go that direction, the difference in the cost for our current collection and what would be in with roll carts is about 88 cents to $2 a household less. So the depending on where this falls in here, we would generate, actually need to generate less revenue in the future. And this is actually showing that we do generate less revenue, even though it's a small amount. It's moving in that direction.
Right, and I am going to ask a question that I imagine the answer is that you came up with these fees to make it revenue neutral, that you didn't want to, like, in any way make this be a fee increase. Is that correct?
There would be no fee increase involved. It would
and then if the savings materialize, we could, the utility could eventually reduce the costs.
Defer any rate increase or reduce costs, yes. Again, the pilot would be as realistic as possible to the proposed structure. We are looking at people, we realize that people may need an additional cart if they generate a lot of waste. Additional carts would be available for a fee. An additional bag, occasionally if you have a party and celebrate the Tigers' victory or whatever, then there's provisions that would be available to the residents that they could dispose of those extra bags. Bulky items I've already mentioned. Where does the savings come from? Currently, we have 8 residential routes right now with 2 employees per route. We average 860 homes per house per day per route. Some routes are a lot more than that, some are less. We're proposing with the automated collection to still maintain the 8 routes, but there would only be 1 employee per truck required. That truck, being an automated system, can pick up from each household quicker. And what we are seeing in the industry is anywhere between 1,000 to 1,100 homes as being the norm for automated collection. We have built into the program 2 bulky item trucks to take care of the extra bags and the bulky items, and I think down the road that would be reduced to 1, but initially out to get started with, I think we need 2 trucks. The educational component, which is going to be a big part of this, not only with the pilot users, but the general public, we will provide essentially a roadmap, an owner's manual for it. We would ask that they sign a pledge indicating the fee structure, what to do with the extra bags, et cetera, where to place the container. The pre-pilot survey and a post-pilot survey we hope to do. Establish a lot of human contact. We hope to have a lot of one-on-one with our customers. We would have an electronic form for them to report issues and social media as well to report issues. In addition to working with the pilot users, we would provide presentations to neighborhood associations, provide static displays. We would certainly step up our educational component of roll carts and an automated collection system. Potential ordinance changes. Because this is such a different program from bags, there are going to have to be some changes as to how we handle the trash. We do have a trash out early ordinance right now that says that you cannot set your trash out at the curb prior to 4 p.m. the day prior to your collection day. And I would expect that to follow through with the roll carts. I would also expect that the roll carts would have a time in which they would need to be brought up off the curb. The location of the cart's going to be an issue, especially with an automated truck or collection system. Some of the requirements are that we currently need to adhere to is to be 6 feet away from mailboxes. Other objects as well could cause a problem with collection. So we're going to have to define those over a period of time, and we'll learn a little bit more about it during the pilot. We'll need to address overfilled containers, bulky items, bags left outside the cart, carts used by others, carts that are lost, stolen. All these will need to be addressed, and changes in the ordinance is what I would anticipate. Cleaning of the carts, that's been an issue that if you read any of the Trip Talk items, it's a lot of concern for the general public, and rightfully so. Changes in the ordinance, because right now the ordinance allows for us to, or provides for us to give trash bags to our customers as part of their service. This would need to replace that. And to address multiplex units, where is the line as to whether or not a fourplex can have a roll cart, or should a fourplex have a dumpster, or should a sixplex, et cetera. Those issues would need to be addressed. I turn the pilot project over to Mr. Glasscock.
I'd like to finish up by, I laid some pamphlets on your dais. One of the things that we looked into it from the Bureau of Labor Statistics is that this job is that we do, collecting trash, is not only dirty, it's dangerous. Out of the top 10 most dangerous job, collecting refuse is number 7 for fatal occupations. Police is number 10. And so it's almost double. I'll just say it's about 30 per 100,000 full-time equivalent deaths for a refuse collector. It's about 18, or it is 18 per 100,000 on the police. And so it is a dangerous job. And one of the things, you know, I can say we're not immune to it. We've had a fatality in the city of Columbia with our refuse collection in 2003. We've also had people riding on the back of the vehicle, standing there like you normally see a trash person, and a guy backing the truck up and pinned the gentleman against a telephone pole. We've also had boots cut off from the closer in the back, and so it's very, very dangerous job. And so we're trying to make it as safe as we can for employees and yet deliver a quality service to our citizens.
Yeah.
We'll be happy to answer any questions that council has.
Yeah, well, first of all, this is fatalities. It would be very interesting to look at injuries, because I would imagine the injury rate's even higher for trash than it is, say, for police. I may be wrong about that.
What I was trying to point out is we have had fatalities with that.
That is good, you know, to be reminded of, yeah, that.
Well,
your people.
I wouldn't mind just jumping in at this point. And I'm actually going to probably speak against the pilot project and the overall project itself. I have received, and I think a number of us have received, quite a bit of input from the constituents. And while I don't want to be insensitive to the danger of the job, and I think that I don't know how else we can address it, but we haven't had a discussion regarding how we might be able to address it in terms of training. You know, very well may be that we have to pay our employees more. You know, I just think we haven't exactly had a conversation concerning what other options we have for making this job less dangerous for employees, because I do not want to be insensitive. On the other hand, I just still to this day don't feel that we have had a compelling case made by our staff, who I love, and they do a great job, but a compelling case made for roll carts in Columbia at this point. Now, we may be at a different stage, maybe a year or two down the road. I'm not sure if we want to readdress it, but at this point, I think it's been clear to me that I don't think it's time. And so I do not even feel that we as a city should embark on the pilot project. I'm not exactly even sure how a pilot project can work unless you take one neighborhood, you know, and do the whole neighborhood as a whole. And you can't ask people to do it if they're not going to be willing to volunteer. And I've heard, as I said, quite a bit of negative comments about this project. So I really am not even in favor of moving forward with the roll cart pilot project.
It actually might help if we all sort of, you know, in terms of the public hearing, if we all say what we think. I've been telling people as they call, because people have asked me not to vote for the pilot project, but I think if we get these injury numbers, the injury numbers are going to look even worse, and I think we have a duty to the workers to look into this. And so I'm intending to vote for the pilot and against the roll carts. And when we come to the, you may even want to address it now. I don't know if we have time before our break, before the meeting, but the truck purchase schedule, if that's, that may actually already be in this packet somewhere.
And we may not have time today to go into that.
If you can defer for a year on the CNG trucks or buy one or two, and then I don't know, I'm presuming you can use a regular, I'm assuming you can use the new truck as an old truck that you can still tip, even though it's got, even though you've paid for the arm.
Well, we would delay compressed natural gas conversion until this was decided one way or another. And then we can pick that up, no matter how this goes, we can pick that up after.
But there's enough of a toll of human suffering that I think we should proceed with the project, and I'll vote accordingly. I know some of the public isn't going to like that, but yeah, you know, people are getting hurt.
We're just trying to get sort of a sense of council at this point.
What was our guarantee on compressed natural gas? Was there a monthly guarantee? Number of gallons used?
We have to produce so much gallon, yes. We have to use so much.
How much is it?
And I don't remember right off the top of my head, sir.
15,000.
Can we do that? And we can't
do that.
Can
do that with either type of truck.
Well, we're looking at changing out the buses and those things too.
Right.
That's a fairly easy target.
Would that be enough for us to build the station?
Yeah, I mean, we'd have a compressor charge as the upcharge is where they get that at, is what you're paying for.
Mm. Yeah.
We only have about three more minutes before 7 o'clock, so I want to get some input from the rest of council.
I'd like to see us move forward with the pilot. I think there's some significant safety issues that we're honor-bound to at least take a look at. No one's forced to go into the pilot at this point. We can decide that it's not how we want to go as a community, but I don't want to see the discussion end right here and say, well, we're not going to do it before we've kind of fully looked at potential cost savings, safety issues, and weigh those versus convenience and the other issues with the current system.
If I could join in, because I want fellow council members to hear this before they make a position. But initially, I wanted to be open to a pilot project. We've heard a lot. Input from citizens is about 80% against it, both people who are contacting me and people I just ask when I'm talking about another issue, so I want a wide variety of input. But I wanted to be open to a pilot project if to see if people who really hate it once they do it like it or it's okay, or if there's even more problems than they even imagined. Except I don't think this pilot project, this is not acceptable and won't be what a good pilot project. You have to do a concentrated neighborhood to see how it works in East Campus. You have to have the whole neighborhood or at least many, many blocks participating, both people who want to participate and people who are just tuned out and aren't paying attention and just have to do it to get a really good read. There's areas in the 6th Ward where there's parking, there's mailboxes right on the curbs. There's no way to be 6 feet away from the curb. I mean, large sections around Bearfield. And then I was really concerned about the education component because it looks like the city has plans to promote the roll carts before we get input and statistics data back from the pilot. So I have a real problem promoting a program among the general public if they're not participating in the pilot while we're doing the pilot before. It's a waste of time and resources if the pilot tells us, no, people don't want it, it's not working well. Personally, I took a roll cart and that had some recyclables in it about the same size and tried moving it, and it was very difficult. And we have a high senior population. We have a big student transient population, and I see tremendous, you know, problems, but the pilot has to be designed right, and this isn't it.
I agree with that. The pilot system, the way you've got with the map, with the dots all over the map, I agree with everybody. It's got to be in a neighborhood in a couple of the wards and large neighborhoods and using the truck with the arm on it so that you get a real-world example of what's going to happen. And everyone can make a decision. We do have to do the pilot program in some way so that we can get the information to make the decision.
And then I would say 6 months is way too long to make people do this, especially if it's not going well. I certainly don't want to put that on the citizens.
So I know the
3 months, 2 months should tell us a lot.
The sound people are going to want to break between the pre-meeting and the meeting to change over the sound. And maybe during that time I can ask you, no, I forgot what the question is, but I'll think of it.
And we need to still hear from Mr. Kespel.
I'm in favor of the pilot. I think the points made are good. I think 6 months may be too long. When I initially heard about the pilot, I envisioned doing streets that were contiguous with one another because the truck could go out and just do that one area rather than running all over town. So I think it may be need to rethink the pilot a little bit, although I am in favor of doing it.
May I just add one more quick thing? If we're doing this pilot or we're going to do these roll carts based on injuries of our employees, may we have some more information on the injuries? Because we just have been all over the map in terms of alleging of injuries, what they are, you know, talking about dangerous, but we really have never actually hashed that out or received data on that.
The Missourian did a good job of covering it, the Sunday Missourian article. I want to put a plug in for a local paper there. It was a pretty well-researched article, I thought.
We have those, Ms. Anthony.
Yeah, we will get you more information. We can't get too specific. We have to guard the health privacy of employees, but
right.
We can get you more than you have to date. My sense of the consensus is to move forward with the pilot, but to put in somewhere the ability to do a concentrated area, a whole neighborhood, use the actual automated truck, and come back with that as part of the plan before we move forward.
So that will come back before council, before it's done, the restructured pilot.
Yes, we'll show you what that new pilot looks like with these
for
added
council input. Yeah.
So okay. Can we then disconnect it from the budget vote for tonight, or can we vote for a pilot with these amendments?
Yes, the moving to the roll cart system is not part of the budget, so it's
okay.
And I'd also like to see a report
on
a report on 10-year savings.
If you
can go out and just see what the savings is for 10 years by going to the roll carts or not.
This has nothing to do with the pilot, but it does also. I would also like to have some information on biodegradable bags.
Sure.
So we'll take a 5-minute break and then come back for the regular council session.